Stark of Winterfell.
Catelyn.
Rob. She knew the moment she heard the kennels erupt. Her son had returned to Riverrun, and Grey Wind with him. Only the scent of the great grey direwolf could send the hounds into such a frenzy of baying and barking. "He will come to me," she knew. Edmure had not returned after his first visit, preferring to spend his days with Mark Piper and Patrick Mallister, listening to Ryman the Rhymer's verses about the battle at the Stone Mill. "Rob is not Edmure, though. Rob will see me." It had been raining for days now, a cold grey downpour that well suited Catelyn's mood. Her father was growing weaker and more delirious with every passing day, waking only to mutter, "Tansy," and beg forgiveness. Edmure shunned her, and Sir Desmond Grell still denied her freedom of the castle, however unhappy it seemed to make him. Only the return of Sir Robin Rygar and his men, foot-weary and drenched to the bone, served to lighten her spirits. They had walked back, it seemed. Somehow the Kingslayer had contrived to sink their galley and escape, Maester Wyman confided. Catelyn asked if she might speak with Sir Robin to learn more of what had happened, but that was refused her. Something else was wrong as well. On the day her brother returned, a few hours after their argument, she had heard angry voices from the yard below. When she climbed to the roof to see, there were knots of men gathered across the castle beside the main gate. Horses were being led from the stable, saddled and bridled, and there was shouting, though Catelyn was too far away to make out the words. One of Rob's white banners lay on the ground, and one of the knights turned his horse and trampled over the direwolf as he spurred toward the gate. Several others did the same. "Those are men who fought with Edmure on the fords," she thought. "What could have made them so angry? Has my brother slighted them somehow? Given them some insult?" She thought she recognized Sir Perwin Frey, who had travelled with her to Bitterbridge and Storm's End and back, and his bastard half-brother, Martin Rivers, as well, but from this vantage it was hard to be certain. Close to 40 men poured out through the castle gates, to what end she did not know. They did not come back. Nor would Maester Wyman tell her who they had been, where they had gone, or what had made them so angry.
"I'm here to say to your father, and only that, my lady," he said. "Your brother will soon be Lord of Riverrun. What he wishes you to know, he must tell you."
But now Rob was returned from the west, returned in triumph. "He will forgive me," Catelyn told herself. "He must forgive me. He is my own son, and Arya and Sansa are as much his blood as mine. He will free me from these rooms, and then I will know what has happened." By the time Sir Desmond came for her, she had bathed and dressed and combed out her auburn hair.
"King Rob has returned from the west, my lady," the knight said, "and commands that you attend him in the great hall."
It was the moment she had dreamed of and dreaded. Have I lost two sons, or three? She would know soon enough. The hall was crowded when they entered. Every eye was on the dais, but Catelyn knew their backs. Lady Mormont's patched ringmail, the great John and his son looming over every other head in the hall. Lord Jason Mallister, white-haired with his winged helm in the crook of his arm. Titus Blackwood in his magnificent raven-feather cloak. Half of them will want to hang me now. The other half may only turn their eyes away. She had an uneasy feeling that someone was missing, too. Rob stood on the dais. He is a boy no longer, she realized with a pang. He's 16 now, a man grown. Just look at him. War had melted all the softness from his face and left him hard and lean. He had shaved his beard away, but his auburn hair fell uncut to his shoulders. The recent rains had rusted his mail and left brown stains on the white of his cloak and surcoat. Perhaps the stains were blood. On his head was a sword crown. They had fashioned him of bronze and iron. He bears it more comfortably now. He bears it like a king. Edmure stood below the crowded dais, head bowed modestly, as Rob praised his victory. Fell at the stone mill. Shall never be forgotten. Small wonder Lord Tywin ran off to fight Stannis. He'd had his fill of Northmen and Rivermen both. That brought laughter and approving shouts, but Rob raised a hand for quiet. Make no mistake, though, the Lannisters will march again, and there will be other battles to win before the kingdom is secure. The great John roared out, King in the North! And thrust a mailed fist into the air. The river lords answered with a shout of, King of the Trident! The hall grew thunderous with pounding fists and stamping feet. Only a few noted Catelyn and Sir Desmond amidst the tumult, but they elbowed their fellows, and slowly a hush grew around her. She held her head high and ignored the eyes. Let them think what they will. It is Rob's judgment that matters. The sight of Sir Brynden Tully's craggy face on the dais gave her comfort. A boy she did not know seemed to be acting as Rob's squire. Behind him stood a young knight in a sand-coloured surcoat blazoned with seashells, and an older one who wore three black pepper pots on a saffron bend across a field of green and silver stripes. Between them were a handsome older lady and a pretty maid who looked to be her daughter. There was another girl as well, near Sansa's age. The seashells were the sigil of some lesser house, Catelyn knew. The older man's she did not recognize. Prisoners? Why would Rob bring captives onto the dais? Uthryth Wayne banged his staff on the floor as Sir Desmond escorted her forward. If Rob looks at me as Edmure did, I do not know what I will do. But it seemed to her that it was not anger she saw in her son's eyes, but something else. Apprehension, perhaps. No, that made no sense. What should he fear? He was the young wolf, king of the Trident and the North. Her uncle was the first to greet her. As black a fish as ever, Sir Brynden had no care for what the others might think. He leapt off the dais and pulled Catelyn into his arms. When he said, "It's good to see you home, Cat," she had to struggle to keep her composure. "And you," she whispered. "Mother." Catelyn looked up at her tall, kingly son. "Your Grace, I have prayed for your safe return. I had heard you were wounded. I took an arrow through the arm while storming the crag," he said. "It healed well, though. I had the best of care." "The gods are good, then." Catelyn took a deep breath. "Say it. It cannot be avoided." "They will have told you what I did." "Did they tell you my reasons?" "For the girls. I had 5 children. Now I have 3.
"Aye, my lady."
Lord Rickard Carstark pushed past the Great John, like some grim spectre, with his black mail and long, ragged grey beard, his narrow face pinched and cold.
"And I have 1 son, who once had 3. You have robbed me of my vengeance."
Catelyn faced him calmly. "Lord Rickard, the Kingslayer's dying would not have bought life for your children. His living may buy life for mine." The lord was unappeased.
"Jaime Lannister has played you for a fool. You bought a bag of empty words, no more. My Torren and my Eddard deserved better of you."
"Leave off, Carstark,"
grumbled the Great John, crossing his huge arms against his chest.
"It was a mother's folly. Women are made that way."
"A mother's folly?"
Lord Carstark rounded on Lord Umber.
"I name it treason."
"Enough!"
For just an instant, Rob sounded more like Brandon than his father. No man calls my lady Winterfell a traitor in my hearing, Lord Rickard. When he turned to Catelyn, his voice softened. If I could wish the Kingslayer back in chains, I would. You freed him without my knowledge or consent. But what you did, I know you did for love, for Arya and Sansa, and out of grief for Bran and Rickon. Love's not always wise, I've learned. It can lead us to great folly. But we follow our hearts, wherever they take us. Don't we, Mother? Is that what I did? If my heart led me into folly, I would gladly make whatever amends I can to Lord Carstark and yourself. Lord Rickard's face was implacable.
Will your amends warm Torren and Eddard in their cold graves, where the Kingslayer laid them?
He shouldered past the Great John and Mage Mormont and left the hall. Rob made no move to detain him. Forgive him, Mother. If you will forgive me, I have. I know what it is to love so greatly, you can think of nothing else. Catelyn bowed her head.
Thank you. I have not lost this child, at least.
We must talk, Rob went on. You and my uncles, of this and other things. Stuart, call an end. Authorized Wayne slammed his staff on the floor and shouted the dismissal, and river lords and northerners alike moved toward the doors. It was only then that Catelyn realized what was amiss. The wolf. The wolf is not here. Where is Grey Wind? She knew the dire wolf had returned with Rob. She had heard the dogs, but he was not in the hall, not at her son's side where he belonged. Before she could think to question Rob, however, she found herself surrounded by a circle of well-wishers. Lady Mormont took her hand and said,
"My lady, if Cersei Lannister held two of my daughters, I would have done the same."
The Great John, no respecter of proprieties, lifted her off her feet and squeezed her arms with his huge, hairy hands.
"Your wolf pup maul the Kingslayer once. He'll do it again, if need be."
Gorbart Glover and Lord Jason Mallister were cooler, and Jonas Bracken almost icy, but their words were courteous enough. Her brother was the last to approach her.
"I pray for your girls as well, Cat. I hope you do not doubt that."
"Of course not." She kissed him. "I love you for it." When all the words were done, the Great Hall of Riverrun was empty, save for Rob, the three Tullys, and the six strangers Catelyn could not place. She eyed them curiously. "My lady, sirs, are you new to my son's cause?" "New," said the younger knight, him of the seashells, "but fierce in our courage and firm in our loyalties, as I hope to prove to you, my lady." Rob looked uncomfortable. "Mother," he said, "may I present the Lady Sybil, the wife of Lord Gawain Westling of the Crag?" The older woman came forward with solemn mien. Her husband was one of those we took captive in the Whispering Wood.
"Westling, yes," Catelyn thought. "Their banner is six seashells, white on sand. A minor house sworn to the Lannisters."
Rob beckoned the other strangers forward, each in turn. "Sir Rolf Spicer, Lady Sybil's brother. He was castellan at the Crag when we took it." The Pepperpot Knight inclined his head, a square-built man with a broken nose and a close-cropped grey beard. He looked doughty enough. "The children of Lord Gawain and Lady Sybil?" "Sir Reynard Westerling." The Seashell Knight smiled beneath a bushy moustache. Young, lean, rough-hewn, he had good teeth and a thick mop of chestnut hair. "Elenia?" The little girl did a quick curtsy. "Rolam Westerly, my squire." The boy started to kneel, saw no one else was kneeling, and bowed instead. "The honour is mine," Catelyn said.
"Can Rob have won the Crag's allegiance?"
If so, it was no wonder the Westlings were with him. Custly Rock did not suffer such betrayals gently, not since Tywin Lannister had been old enough to go to war. The maid came forward last, and very shy, Rob took her hand. "Mother," he said, "I have the great honour to present you the Lady Jane Westerling, Lord Gawain's elder daughter and my lady wife." The first thought that flew across Catelyn's mind was, "No, that cannot be. You're only a child." The second was, "And besides, you have pledged another." The third was, "Mother, have mercy. Rob, what have you done?" Only then came her belated remembrance. "Follies done for love? He has bagged me neat as a hare in the snare. I seem to have already forgiven him." Mixed with her annoyance was a rueful admiration. The scene had been staged with a cunning worthy of a master mummer, or a king. Catelyn saw no choice but to take Jane Westling's hands. "I have a new daughter," she said, more stiffly than she'd intended. She kissed the terrified girl on both cheeks. "Be welcome to our hall and hearth."
"Thank you, my lady. I shall be a good and true wife to Rob, I swear, and as wise a queen as I can."
Queen? Yes, this pretty little girl is a queen. I must remember that.
She was pretty, undeniably, with her chestnut curls and heart-shaped face and that shy smile. Slender, but with good hips, Catelyn noted. She should have no trouble bearing children, at least. Lady Sybil took a hand before any more was said.
"We are honoured to be joined to House Stark, my lady, but we are also very wary. We have come a long way in a short time. Perhaps we might retire to our chambers, so you may visit with your son."
"That would be best." Rob kissed his Jane. "The steward will find you suitable accommodations."
"I'll take you to him," Sir Edmure Tully volunteered.
"You are most kind," said Lady Sybil.
"Must I go too?" asked the boy Roland. "I'm your squire."
Rob laughed. "But I'm not in need of squiring just now."
"Oh."
"His Grace has gotten along for 16 years without you, Roland," said Sir Reynold of the Seashells. "He will survive a few hours more, I think."
Taking his little brother firmly by the hand, he walked him from the hall. "Your wife is lovely," Catelyn said, when they were out of earshot. "And the Westerlings seem worthy, though Lord Gawain is Tywin Lannister's sworn man, is he not?" "Yes. Jason Malister captured him in the Whispering Wood and has been holding him at sea guard for ransom. Of course I'll free him now, though he may not wish to join me. We wed without his consent, I fear, and this marriage puts him in dire peril. The crag is not strong. For love of me, Jane may lose all." "And you," she said softly, "have lost the phrase." His wince told all. She understood the angry voices now, why Perwin Frey and Martin Rivers had left in such haste, trampling Rob's banner into the ground as they went. "Dare I ask how many swords come with your bride, Rob?"
50, a dozen knights."
His voice was glum, as well it might be. When the marriage contract had been made at the Twins, old Lord Walder Frey had sent Rob off with 1,000 mounted knights and near 3,000 foot. "Jane is bright as well as beautiful, and kind as well. She has a gentle heart."
"It is swords you need, not gentle hearts. How could you do this, Rob? How could you be so heedless, so stupid? How could you be so very young?"
Reproaches would not serve here, however. All she said was, "Tell me how this came to be."
"I took her castle, and she took my heart," Rob smiled. "The crag was weakly garrisoned, so we took it by storm one night. Black Walder and the Small John led scaling parties over the walls, while I broke through the main gate with a ram. I took an arrow in the arm just before Sir Rolf yielded us the castle. It seemed nothing at first, but it festered. Jane had me taken to her own bed, and she nursed me until the fever passed.
And she was with me when the great John brought me the news of Winterfell, Bran, and Rickon. He seemed to have trouble saying his brothers' names. That night she comforted me, Mother. Catelyn did not need to be told what sort of comfort Jane Westling had offered her son. And you wed her the next day? He looked in her eyes, proud and miserable all at once. It was the only honourable thing to do. She's gentle and sweet, Mother. She will make me a good wife. Perhaps that will not appease Lord Frey. I know, her son said, stricken. I've made a botch of everything but the battles, haven't I? I thought the battles would be the hard part, but if I had listened to you and kept Theon as my hostage, I still rule the North, and Bran and Rickon would be alive and safe in Winterfell. Perhaps, or not. Lord Balin might still have chanced war. The last time he reached for a crown, it cost him 2 sons. He might have thought it a bargain to lose only 1 this time. She touched his arm. What happened with the Freys, after you wed? Rob shook his head. With Sir Stevron, I might have been able to make amends, but Sir Ryman is dull-witted as a stone. And Blackwalder, that one was not named for the colour of his beard, I promise you. He went so far as to say that his sisters would not be loath to wed a widower. I would have killed him for that, if Jane had not begged me to be merciful. You have done House Frey a grievous insult, Rob. I never meant to. Sir Stevron died for me, and Olivar was as loyal a squire as any king could want. He asked to stay with me, but Sir Ryman took him with the rest, all their strength. The great John urged me to attack them. Fighting your own in the midst of your enemies, she said, it would have been the end of you. Yes, I thought perhaps we could arrange other matches for Lord Walder's daughters. Sir Wendell Manderley has offered to take one, and the great John tells me his uncles wish to wed again. If Lord Walder will be reasonable... He is not reasonable, said Catelyn. He is proud and prickly to a fault, you know that. He wanted to be a grandfather to a king. You will not appease him with the offer of 2 hoary old brigands and the 2nd son of the fattest man in the 7 kingdoms. Not only have you broken your oath, but you've slighted the honour of the twins by choosing a bride from a lesser house. Rob bristled at that. The Westerlings are better blood than the Freys. They're an ancient line, descended from the first men. The kings of the Rock sometimes wed Westerlings before the conquest, and there was another Jane Westerling who was queen to King Maegor 300 years ago. All of which will only salt Lord Walder's wounds. It has always rankled him that older houses look down on the Freys as upstarts. This insult is not the first he's borne to hear him tell it. John Aaron was disinclined to foster his grandsons, and my father refused the offer of one of his daughters for Edmure. She inclined her head toward her brother as he rejoined them. "Your Grace," Brynden Blackfish said, "perhaps we had best continue this in private." "Yes," Rob sounded tired. "I would kill for a cup of wine. The audience chamber, I think." As they started up the steps, Catelyn asked a question that had been troubling her since she entered the hall. "Rob, where is Grey Wind?" "In the yard, with a haunch of mutton. I told the kennel-master to see that he was fed." "You always kept him with you before." "A hall is no place for a wolf. He gets restless, you've seen, growling and snapping. I should never have taken him into battle with me. He's killed too many men to fear them now. Jane's anxious around him, and he terrifies her mother." "And there's the heart of it," Catelyn thought. "He is part of you, Rob. To fear him is to fear you." "I'm not a wolf, no matter what they call me." Rob sounded cross. "Grey Wind killed a man at the Crag, another at Ashmark, and 6 or 7 at Oxcross. If you had seen—" "I saw Bran's wolf tear out a man's throat at Winterfell. she said sharply, and loved him for it. That's different. The man at the crag was a knight. Jane had known all her life. You can't blame her for being afraid. Grey Wynne doesn't like her uncle either. He bares his teeth every time Sir Rolf comes near him. A chill went through her. Send Sir Rolf away. At once. Where? Back to the crag, so the Lannisters can mount his head on a spike? Jane loves him. He's her uncle. And a fair knight, besides. I need more men like Rolf Spicer, not fewer. I'm not going to banish him just because my wolf doesn't seem to like the way he smells. Rob, she stopped and held his arm. I told you once to keep Theon Greyjoy close, and you did not listen. Listen now. Send this man away. I'm not saying you must banish him. Find some task that requires a man of courage, some honourable duty. What it is matters not, but do not keep him near you. He frowned. Should I have Grey Wynne sniff all my knights? There might be others who smell he mislikes. Any man Grey Wynne mislikes is a man I do not want close to you. These wolves are more than wolves, Rob. You must know that. I think perhaps the guards sent them to us. Your father's guards, the old guards of the north. Five wolf pups, Rob. Five for five Stark children. Six, said Rob. There was a wolf for John as well. I found them, remember? I know how many there were and where they came from. I used to think the same as you, that the wolves were our guardians, our protectors, until, she prompted. Rob's mouth tightened. Until they told me that Theon had murdered Bran and Rickon. Small good their wolves did them. I'm no longer a boy, Mother. I'm a king, and I can protect myself. He sighed. I will find some duty for Sir Rolf, some pretext to send him away. Not because of his smell, but to ease your mind. You have suffered enough. Relieved, Catelyn kissed him lightly on the cheek before the others could come around the turn of the stair, and for a moment he was her boy again, not her king. Lord Huster's private audience chamber was a small room above the great hall, better suited to intimate discussions. Rob took the high seat, removed his crown, and set it on the floor beside him as Catelyn rang for wine. Edmure was filling his uncle's ear with the whole story of the fight at the stone mill. It was only after the servants had come and gone that the Blackfish cleared his throat and said, I think we've all heard sufficient of your boasting, nephew. Edmure was taken aback.
Boasting? What do you mean?
I mean, said the Blackfish, that you owe his grace your thanks for his forbearance. He played out that mummer's farce in the great hall, so as not to shame you before your own people. Had it been me, I would have flayed you for your stupidity rather than praising this folly of the fords.
Good men died to defend those fords, uncle,
Edmure sounded outraged.
What? Is no one to win victories by the young wolf? Did I steal some glory meant for you, Rob?
Your grace, Rob corrected icy. You took me for your king, uncle. Or have you forgotten that as well? The Blackfish said, You were commander to hold River Run, Edmure. No more.
I held River Run, and I blooded Lord Tywin's nose.
So you did, said Rob. But a bloody nose won't win the war, will it? Did you ever think to ask yourself why we remained in the West so long after Oxcross? You knew I did not have enough men to threaten Lannisport or Casterly Rock.
Why? There were other castles. Gold, cattle.
You think we stayed for plunder? Rob was incredulous. Uncle, I wanted Lord Tywin to come west. We were all horsed, Sir Brynden said. The Lannister host was mainly foot. We planned to run Lord Tywin a merry chase up and down the coast, then slip behind him,
to take a strong defensive position athwart the Gold Road, at a place my scouts had found where the ground would have been greatly in our favour. If he had come at us there, he would have paid a grievous price. But if he did not attack, he would have been trapped in the west, 1,000 leagues from where he needed to be. All the while, we would have lived off his land instead of him living off ours.
Lord Stannis was about to fall upon King's Landing, Rob said. He might have rid us of Joffrey, the Queen, and the Imp in one red stroke. Then we might have been able to make a peace. Edmure looked from uncle to nephew.
You never told me.
I told you to hold River Run, said Rob. What part of that command did you fail to comprehend?
When you stopped Lord Tywin on the Red Fork, said the Blackfish, you delayed him just long enough for riders out of Bitterbridge to reach him with word of what was happening to the east. Lord Tywin turned to his host at once, joined up with Mathis Rowan and Randall Tarley near the headwaters of the Blackwater, and made a forced march to Tumbler's Falls, where he found Mace Tyrell and two of his sons waiting with a huge host and a fleet of barges. They floated down the river, disembarked half a day's ride from the city, and took Stannis in the rear. Catelyn remembered King Renly's court, as she had seen it at Bitterbridge. 1,000 golden roses streaming in the wind, Queen Marjorie's shy smile and soft words, her brother, the Knight of Flowers, with a bloody linen around his temples. If you had to fall in a woman's arms, my son, why couldn't they have been Marjorie Tyrell's? The wealth and power of Highgarden could have made all the difference in the fighting yet to come, and perhaps Grey Wind would have liked the smell of her as well. Edmure looked ill.
Never, Rob. You must let me make amends. I will lead the van in the next battle.
For amends, brother? Or for glory? Catelyn wondered.
The next battle, Rob said. Well, that will be soon enough. Once Joffrey is wed, the Lannisters will take the field against me once more, I don't doubt. And this time the Tyrells will march beside them. And I may need to fight the Freys as well, if Black Walder has his way.
So long as Theon Greyjoy sits in your father's seat, with your brother's blood on his hands, these other foes must wait, Catelyn told her son. Your first duty is to defend your own people, win back Winterfell, and hang Theon in a crow's cage to die slowly. Or else, put off that crown for good, Rob, for men will know that you are no true king at all. From the way Rob looked at her, she could tell that it had been a long while since anyone had dared speak to him so bluntly. When they told me Winterfell had fallen, I wanted to go north at once, he said, with a hint of defensiveness. I wanted to free Bran and Rickon, but I thought, I never dreamed that Theon could harm them, truly. If I had, it's too late for ifs, and too late for rescues, Catelyn said. All that remains is vengeance.
The last word we had from the north, Sir Roderick had defeated a force of iron men near Torren Square, and was assembling a host at Castle Serwyn to retake Winterfell, said Rob. By now he may have done it. There has been no news for a long time. And what of the Trident? If I turn north, I can't ask the River Lords to abandon their own people.
No, said Catelyn. Leave them to guard their own, and win back the north, with Northmen.
How will you get the Northmen to the north? Her brother Edmure asked. The Iron Men control the Sunset Sea. The Greyjoys hold Moat Cailin as well. No armies ever taken Moat Cailin from the south. Even to march against it, it's madness. We could be trapped on the causeway, with the Ironborn before us and angry Freys at our back.
We must win back the Freys, said Rob. With them, we still have some chance of success, however small. Without them, I see no hope. I'm willing to give Lord Walder whatever he requires, apologies, honours, lands, gold. There must be something that would soothe his pride.
Not something,
said Catelyn. Someone.
John.
Big enough for you. Snowflake speckled Tormund's broad face, melting in his hair and beard.
The giants swayed slowly atop the mammoths as they rode past two by two. John's Garen shied, frightened by such strangeness, but whether it was the mammoths or their riders that scared him, it was hard to say. Even Ghost backed off a step, baring his teeth in a silent snarl. The dire wolf was big, but the mammoths were a deal bigger, and there were many and more of them. John took the horse in hand and held him still, so he could count the giants emerging from the blowing snow and pale mist that swirled along the milk water. He was well beyond 50 when Tormund said something, and he lost the count. There must be hundreds. No matter how many went past, they just seemed to keep coming. In old Nan's stories, giants were outsized men who lived in colossal castles, fought with huge swords, and walked about in boots a boy could hide in. These were something else, more bear-like than human, and as woolly as the mammoths they rode. Seated, it was hard to say how big they truly were. 10 feet tall, maybe, or 12, John thought, maybe 14, but no taller. Their sloping chests might have passed for those of men, but their arms hung down too far, and their lower torsos looked half again as wide as their upper. Their legs were shorter than their arms, but very thick, and they wore no boots at all. Their feet were broad splayed things, hard and horny and black. Neckless, their huge heavy heads thrust forward from between their shoulder blades, and their faces were squashed and brutal. Rat's eyes, no larger than beads, were almost lost within the folds of horny flesh, but they snuffled constantly, smelling as much as they saw.
They're not wearing skins, John realized. That's hair.
Shaggy pelts covered their bodies, thick below the waist, sparser above. The stink that came off them was choking, but perhaps that was the mammoths. And Joramun blew the horn of winter and woke giants from the earth. He looked for great swords 10 feet long, but saw only clubs. Most were just the limbs of dead trees, some still trailing shattered branches. A few had stone balls lashed to the ends to make colossal mauls.
The song never says if the horn can put them back to sleep.
One of the giants coming up on them looked older than the rest. His pelt was grey and streaked with white, and the mammoth he rode, larger than any of the others, was grey and white as well. Tormund shouted something up to him as he passed, harsh, clanging words, in a tongue that John did not comprehend. The giant's lips split apart to reveal a mouth full of huge square teeth, and he made a sound half belch and half rumble. After a moment, John realized he was laughing. The mammoth turned his massive head to regard the two of them briefly, one huge tusk passing over the top of John's head as the beast lumbered by, leaving huge footprints in the soft mud and fresh snow along the river. The giant shouted down something in the same coarse tongue that Tormund had used. "Was that their king?" asked John.
"Giants have no kings, no more than mammoths do, nor snow bears, nor the great whales of the grey sea. That was Magmar Tondorweg, Mag the Mighty. You can kneel to him if you like. He won't mind. I know your kneeler's knees must be itching for want of some king to bend to. Watch out he don't step on you, though. Giants have bad eyes, and might be he wouldn't see some little crow all the way down there by his feet."
"What did you say to him? Was that the old tongue?"
"Aye. I asked him if that was his father he was forking. They looked so much alike, except his father had a better smell."
"And what did he say to you?"
Tormund Thunderfist cracked a gap-toothed smile.
"He asked me if that was my daughter riding there beside me with her smooth pink cheeks."
The wildling shook snow from his arm and turned his horse about.
It may be he never saw a man without a beard before.
Come, we start back. Mans grow sore wroth when I'm not found in my accustomed place.
John wheeled and followed Tormund back toward the head of the column, his new cloak hanging heavy from his shoulders. It was made of unwashed sheepskins, worn fleece side in, as the wildling suggested. It kept the snow off well enough, and at night it was good and warm, but he kept his black cloak as well, folded up beneath his saddle. "Is it true you killed a giant once?" he asked Tormund as they rode. Ghost loped silently beside them, leaving poor prince in the new-fallen snow.
"Now why would you doubt a mighty man like me? It was winter, and I was half a boy, and stupid the way boys are. I went too far, and my horse died, and then a storm caught me, a true storm, not no little dustin such as this. Ah! I knew I'd freeze to death before it broke. So I found me a sleeping giant, cut open her belly, and crawled up right inside her. Kept me warm enough, she did, but the stink ne'er did for me. The worst thing was, she woke up when the spring come, and took me for a babe, suckled me for 3 whole moons before I could get away. Ah, there's times I miss the taste of giant's milk, though.
If she nursed you, you couldn't have killed her.
I never did. But see, you don't go spreading that about. Tormund Giant's Bane has a better ring to it than Tormund Giant's Babe, and that's the honest truth of it.
So how did you come by your other names? John asked. Mans called you the Hornblower, didn't he? Mead King of Ruddy Hall, husband to bears, father to hosts. It was the hornblowing he particularly wanted to hear about, but he dare not ask too plainly. And Jaruman blew the horn of winter and woke giants from the earth. Is that where they had come from? Them and their mammoths? Had Mance Raider found the horn of Jaruman and given it to Thormund Thunderfist to blow?
Are all crows so curious? Asked Tormund. Well, here's a tale for you. It were another winter, colder even than the one I spent inside the giant, and snowing day and night, snowflakes as big as a head. Not these little things. It snowed so hard the old village was half buried. I was in me ruddy hall, with only a cask of mead to keep me company, and nothing to do but drink it. The more I drank, the more I got to thinking about this woman lived close by, a fine, strong woman, with the biggest pair of tits she ever saw. She had a temper on her, that one. But, oh, she could be warm, too. And in the depth of winter, a man needs his warmth. The more I drank, the more I thought about her, and the more I thought, the harder me member got, till I couldn't suffer it no more. Fool that I was, I bundled myself up in furs from head to heels, wrapped a winding wool around me face, and set off to find her. The snow was coming down so hard, I got turned around once or twice, and the wind blew right through me, and froze me bones, but finally I come on her, all bundled up like I was. The woman had a terrible temper, and she put up quite a fight when I laid hands on her. It was all I could do to carry her home and get her out of them furs. But when I did, oh, she was hotter even than I remembered, and we had a fine old time. And then I went to sleep. Next morning, when I woke, the snow had stopped, and the sun was shining. But I was in no fit state to enjoy it. All ripped and torn I was, and half my member bit right off. And there, on my floor, was a she-bear's pelt. And soon enough, the free folk were telling tales of this bald bear seen in the woods, with the queerest pair of cubs behind her. Ha! He slapped a meaty thigh. Would that I could find her again. She was fine to lay with, that bear. Never was a woman gave me such a fight, nor such strong sons neither.
What could you do if you did find her? John asked, smiling.
You said she bit your member off.
Only half. And half my member is twice as long as any other man's,
Tormon snorted.
Now, as to you, is it true they cut your members off when they take you for the wall?
No, John said, affronted.
I think it must be true. Else, why refuse Ygritte? She'd hardly give you any fight at all, seems to me. The girl wants you in her. That's plain enough to see.
Too bloody plain, thought John, and it seems that half the column has seen it. He studied the falling snow so Tormund might not see him redden. I am a man of the night's watch, he reminded himself. So why did he feel like some blushing maid? He spent most of his days in Ygritte's company, and most nights as well. Mansraider had not been blind to Rattleshirt's mistrust of the crow-come-over. So after he had given John his new sheepskin cloak, he had suggested that he might want to ride with Tormund Giantsbane instead. John had happily agreed, and the very next day Ygritte and Longspear Rick left Rattleshirt's band for Tormund's as well.
"Free folk ride with who they want," the girl told him, "and we had a bellyful of bag of bones."
Every night when they made camp, Ygritte threw her sleeping skins down beside his own, no matter if he was near the fire or well away from it. Once he woke to find her nestling against him, her arm across his chest. He lay listening to her breathe for a long time, trying to ignore the tension in his groin. Rangers often shared skins for warmth, but warmth was not all Ygritte wanted, he suspected. After that he had taken to using ghosts to keep her away. Old Nan used to tell stories about knights and their ladies who would sleep in a single bed with a blade between them for honour's sake, but he thought this must be the first time where a direwolf took the place of the sword. Even then Ygritte persisted. The day before last, John had made the mistake of wishing he had hot water for a bath.
"Cold is better," she had said at once. "If you've got someone to warm you up after, the river's only part ice yet. Go on."
John laughed. "You'd freeze me to death."
"Are all crows afraid of goose prickles? A little ice won't kill you. I'll jump in with you to prove it so."
"And ride the rest of the day with wet clothes, frozen to our skins?" he objected.
"Jon Snow, you know nothing. You don't go in with clothes."
"I don't go in at all," he said firmly, just before he heard Tormund Thunderfist bellowing for him. He hadn't, but never mind. The wildling seemed to think Ygritte a great beauty because of her hair. Red hair was rare among the free folk, and those who had it were said to be kissed by fire, which was supposed to be lucky. Lucky it might be, and red it certainly was, but Ygritte's hair was such a tangle that John was tempted to ask her if she only brushed it at the changing of the seasons. At a lord's court, the girl would never have been considered anything but common, he knew. She had a round, peasant face, a pug nose, and slightly crooked teeth, and her eyes were too far apart. John had noticed all that the first time he'd seen her, when his dirk had been at her throat. Lately, though, he was noticing some other things. When she grinned, the crooked teeth didn't seem to matter. And maybe her eyes were too far apart, but they were a pretty blue-grey colour, and lively as any eyes he knew. Sometimes she sang in a low, husky voice that stirred him, and sometimes by the cook fire, when she sat hugging her knees, with the flames waking echoes in her red hair, and looked at him just smiling. Well, that stirred some things as well. But he was a man of the night's watch. He had taken a vow. "I shall take no wife, hold no lands, father no children." He had said the words before the weirwood, before his father's gods. He could not unsay them, no more than he could admit the reason for his reluctance to Tormund Thunderfist, father to bears.
"Do you mislike the girl?"
Tormund asked him as they passed another 20 mammoths, these bearing wildlings in tall wooden towers instead of giants.
"No, but I—" What can I say that he will believe?
I am still too young to wed.
Wed? Tormund laughed. Who spoke of wedding? In the south must a man wed every girl he beds?
John could feel himself turning red again. She spoke for me when Rattleshirt would have killed me. I would not dishonour her.
You're a free man now, and Ygritte is a free woman. What dishonour if you lay together?
I might get her with child.
Aye, I'd hope so. A strong son or a lively laughing girl kissed by fire, eh? Where's the harm in that?
Words failed him for a moment. The boy, the child, would be a bastard.
A bastard's weaker than other children. More sickly, more like to fail.
No, but
you're bastard born yourself, and if Ygritte does not want a child, she will go to some woods witch and drink a cup of moon tea. You do not come into it once the seed is planted.
I will not father a bastard. Tormund shook his shaggy head.
What fools you kneelers be! Why did you steal the girl if you don't want her?
Steal? I never...
You did, said Tormund. You slew the two she was with and carried her off. What do you call it?
I took her prisoner.
You made her yield to you.
Yes, but, Tormund, I swear, I've never touched her.
Are you certain they never cut your member off?
Tormund gave a shrug, as if he would never understand such madness.
Well, you're a free man now. But if you will not have the girl, best find yourself a she-bear. If a man does not use his member, it grows smaller and smaller, until one day he wants to piss and cannot find it.
John had no answer for that. Small wonder that the Seven Kingdoms thought the free folk scarcely human. They have no laws, no honour, not even simple decency. They steal endlessly from each other, breed like beasts, prefer rape to marriage, and fill the world with base-born children. Yet he was growing fond of Tormund Giantsbane, great bag of wind and lies though he was. Longspear as well. And Ygritte? No, I will not think about Ygritte. Along with the Tormunds and the Longspears rode other sorts of wildlings, though, men like Rattleshirt and the Weeper, who would as soon slit you as spit on you. There was Harmer Dogshead, a squat keg of a woman, with cheeks like slabs of white meat, who hated dogs and killed one every fortnight to make a fresh head for her banner. Earless Stir, Magna of Then, whose own people thought him more god than lord. Varamyr Sixskins, a small mouse of a man, whose steed was a savage white snow bear that stood 13 feet tall on its hind legs. And wherever the bear and Varamyr went, three wolves and a shadow cat came following. John had been in his presence only once, and once had been enough. The mere sight of the man had made him bristle, even as the fur on the back of Ghost's neck had bristled at the sight of the bear and that long black-and-white cat. And there were folks fiercer even than Varamyr, from the northernmost reaches of the haunted forest, the hidden valleys of the Frostfangs, and even queerer places, the men of the frozen shore, who rode in chariots made of walrus bones, pulled along by packs of savage dogs, the terrible Ice River clans, who were said to feast on human flesh, the cave dwellers, with their faces dyed blue and purple and green. With his own eyes, John had beheld the Hornfoot men trotting along in columns on bare soles as hard as boiled leather. He had not seen any Snarks or Grumpkins, but for all he knew, Tormund would be having some to supper. Half the wildling host had lived all their lives without so much as a glimpse of the wall, John judged, and most of those spoke no word of the common tongue. It did not matter. Mance Rayder spoke the old tongue, even sang in it, fingering his lute and filling the night with strange wild music. Mance had spent years assembling this vast plodding host,
talking to this clan mother and that Magno, winning one village with sweet words and another with a song and a third with the edge of his sword, making peace between Harmer Dogshead and the Lord of Bones, between the Hornfoots and the Night Runners, between the walrus men of the frozen shore and the cannibal clans of the great ice rivers, hammering 100 different daggers into one great spear aimed at the heart of the Seven Kingdoms. He had no crown nor scepter, no robes of silk and velvet, but it was plain to John that Mansraider was a king in more than name. John had joined the wildlings at Corran Halfhand's command.
"Ride with them, eat with them, fight with them,"
the ranger had told him the night before he died.
"And watch."
But all his watching had learned him little. The Halfhand had suspected that the wildlings had gone up into the bleak and barren Frostfangs in search of some weapon, some power, some fell sorcery with which to break the wall. But if they had found any such, no one was boasting of it openly, or showing it to John. Nor had Mansraider confided any of his plans or strategies. Since that first night, he had hardly seen the man, save at a distance. "I will kill him, if I must." The prospect gave John no joy. There would be no honour in such a killing, and it would mean his own death as well. Yet he could not let the wildlings breach the wall to threaten Winterfell and the north, the Barrowlands and the Rills, White Harbour and the Stony Shore, even the Neck. For 8,000 years the men of House Stark had lived and died to protect their people against such ravagers and reavers. And, bastard-born or no, the same blood ran in his veins. Bran and Rickon are still at Winterfell besides. Maester Lewin, Sir Roderick, old Nan, Farlan the kennel-master, Micken at his forge, and Gage by his ovens, everyone I ever knew, everyone I ever loved. If John must slay a man he half admired and almost liked, to save them from the mercies of Rattleshirt and Harmer Dogshead and the airless Magnar Then, that was what he meant to do. Still he prayed his father's guards might spare him that bleak task. The host moved but slowly, burdened as it was by all the wildlings' herds and children, and mean little treasures, and the snows had slowed its progress even more. Most of the column was out of the foothills now, oozing down along the west bank of the Milkwater like honey on a cold winter's morning, following the course of the river into the heart of the haunted forest. And somewhere close ahead, John knew, the fist of the first men loomed above the trees, home to 300 black brothers of the Night's Watch, armed, mounted, and waiting. The old bear had sent out other scouts besides the Halfhand, and surely Jarman Buckwell or Thorin Smallwood would have returned by now with word of what was coming down out of the mountains. "Mormont will not run," John thought. "He is too old, and he has come too far. He will strike and damn the numbers." One day soon he would hear the sound of war horns and see a column of riders pounding down on them with black cloaks flapping and cold steel in their hands. 300 men could not hope to kill 100 times their number, of course, but John did not think they would need to. He need not slay 1,000, only one. Mance is all that keeps them together. The king beyond the wall was doing all he could, yet the wildlings remained hopelessly undisciplined, and that made them vulnerable. Here and there, within the leagues-long snake that was their line of march, were warriors as fierce as any in the watch. But a good third of them were grouped at either end of the column in Harmer Dogshead's van, and the savage rearguard with its giants, aurochs, and fire-flingers. Another third rode with Mance himself near the centre, guarding the wains and sledges and dog-carts that held the great bulk of the host's provisions and supplies, all that remained of the last summer harvest. The rest divided into small bands under the likes of Rattleshirt, Jarl, Tormund, Giantsbane, and the Weeper, served as outriders, foragers, and whips, galloping up and down the column endlessly to keep it moving in a more or less orderly fashion. And even more telling, only 1 in 100 wildlings was mounted. The old bear would go through them like an axe through porridge. And when that happened, Mansmith gave chase with his